Hello and welcome to our special episode where we talk about the past year's most overrated and underrated films. Since we had so much fun talking about them, we did run a bit long, so we decided to split this episode into two parts. And during this first part, we're going to be talking about 2014's most overrated films. Enjoy and make sure to check out our following episode where we're going to be talking about the underrated picks. Hello and welcome to Over Under Movies, where we pick one overrated and one underrated movie and discuss them. But today is a special episode. It's a year. It's our year-end overrated and underrated movies of 2014 episode, where we're going to be talking about. Each of us are going to pick five overrated and five underrated from 2014. We're just going to talk about them. We're going to agree or disagree and see how that goes. So I'm Octavia Kozak, film critic for The Playlist, Oregon Herald, BayAsparta.com, and DVD Talk.
I'm Eric McClanahan. My podcast is Adjust Your Tracking. I'm the film critic features writer for The Playlist. I do a podcast there as well. And I'm also the lead film critic for Oregon Arts Watch.
And I'm Ryan Oliver, associate editor at GotchaMovies.com and host of the Gotcha Movies podcast.
So I think we're going to start off with overrated, get all the negativity from New Year out of the way.
Oh, yes.
Kind of. And then we're going to talk about all the positive stuff and try to bring up some movies that maybe you might have missed out on, maybe haven't gotten that much press or word of mouth. So we're going to try to maybe hopefully enlighten you about those. But yeah, first let's get the dirty out of the way and start things off with Eric. What's your number five overrated?
My number five is one that we've already talked about a little bit off air, and I'm just going to throw it out there. I will be honest, this isn't necessarily a legit ranking of my movies, but the one I want to get out of the way first is The Imitation Game. You know, pure old-fashioned awards bait, if there ever was a film, you know, if there ever was one, but there's been many this year, especially at the end of 2014, there's been a host of these movies, and especially now that we have both, or all three of us, coming off of a screening for the Martin Luther King movie Selma, it's pretty amazing to see how a good biopic plays versus one that is just extremely by the numbers and palatable enough that you can see why it's popular and gaining all this award steam. But yeah. I just, as a movie, The Imitation Game just has nothing really much to that I got out of it. So
I haven't seen it, but it looks like everything about it that I've seen or read so far looks like exactly what you described. But Ryan has, and I'm sure he has some choice words for it.
Yeah, it was my number four pick, actually.
Okay. Oh, nice.
As well, so I'm with you on that. It's interesting you bring up Selma, as we just got out of that movie, is like what's great about that movie and why that works so much as a biopic is that it functions as a movie. It carves out a place in time and a place in history and just focuses on that. Right. And The Imitation Game, when you say by the numbers, meaning like it tries to do this like decade spanning, like the whole life of Alan Turing, and it's like we don't really need that. We just either need the story about his repressed homosexuality or him trying to crack the Nazi's Enigma code, just but pick something and stick with it. This movie tries to juggle too many balls in the air and a couple fall down. I mean, we got a good Benedict Cumberbatch performance, but it's expected. Like, it's an expected good performance. It's not like a, oh my god, this needs to be showered with Oscars performance.
And yet, we all know it's inevitable. This is one of the movies that apparently is tracking as one of the better awards hopefuls this year. And I just, the fact that it gets into the conversation is what, and then I see the result and I'm just left kind of dumbfounded when I leave. And it's one of those movies where that's what causes me to like it even less. Like, I thought that if the movie was just a movie and I just saw it and it was exactly the same movie that I saw, I'd just walk away and say, oh, well, that was just kind of okay. But the fact that it's getting elevated to this degree is what makes me push hard the other way. And that's why I think it's very clearly an overrated movie. And I just, I think there needs to be a pushback on movies like this because there's just sort of this weird feeling of like blind acceptance. Like, we love you, movie that is easily palatable, so old Academy voters can, like, you know, feel like they've seen something great. And I don't know. I don't agree.
It's not great. It's just fine. It's a fine movie. I felt the exact same way about this King's Speech 4 years ago, which is a much better movie than this one.
Yeah, so if this makes you appreciate King's Speech, there's
something wrong.
Yeah, if that's the bar, I'm not going to bother.
So,
all right. So let's move on to Ryan. What's your number five?
All right, my number five pick is The Interview.
Oh,
yeah, I know. I'm calling out Freedom.
How much did you get paid by North Korea?
I didn't see a cent. You know, for the obvious reasons that most people are saying who have seen this movie, is that what all the fuss was about? Was that worth terrorist threats? Mm. It isn't. I'm going to avoid that because that's what everybody's talking about. For me, I was a huge fan of This Is the End. That movie almost made my top 10 list last year.
It's great.
It was a debut film directed by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg. And that movie, not only was it hilarious, but there was also a confidence in their direction and confidence as filmmakers that I just felt was severely lacking in this movie. Mm. Like, it's got some funny moments. I laughed out loud several times during this movie, but never for a second did I feel like I was watching the same directors who did This Is the End.
Interesting. So kind of a step backwards.
That's how I felt. Backwards, yeah. And, like, granted, this is a bigger canvas than that movie is. I have to give them credit for that. But there was just something clumsily executed about the visual style of the movie and the jokes, which I did find out they didn't actually write the screenplay. They came up with a story. Another guy, and I'm forgetting his name at the moment, wrote the screenplay. Because there's a lot of, there's a lot of, like, homoerotic dick jokes in their movies. We all know that.
Yeah, right.
But course. There was a lot of, like poop humor and, like, mm-hmm. butthole jokes in this movie that I felt like was even below them that just didn't even register for me. And, like, and Seth Rogen's just kind of bland in it. And he usually plays the same character, but he's got great comedic timing. And I'd say, if anything, Randall Park, the guy who plays Kim Jong-un, is the scene stealer in this movie.
Okay. And okay. You mentioned that Seth Rogen was underwhelming. I would also say that James Franco was really fucking annoying in this movie. I mean,
for the most part.
His performance was like this kind of cartoonish mugging, and I guess he was trying to do somewhat of a, I mean, there are attempts here to make some kind of a satire, but you're not dealing with people who are intelligent or like delicate enough to handle something like that. And so it just ends up being like this really broad satire that completely misses the mark. Because you can have a concept like this and have it be under people who are just like really, you can really play around with, that kind of blind, like totalitarian blind authority and how it controls people and how, you know, the fluffy, empty-headed media can like get in there. And then you have like two sides who are just like basically just empty-headed and just controlling the masses, and there could be some interesting stuff in there, but it's like, I just felt like the movie itself didn't have any bite to it. Not that I expected it to. I expected it to be a string of homoerotic jokes mixed with, you know, a bunch of poop jokes and like maybe one or two little attempts here and there to make like, oh, you know, but it doesn't go further beyond like, oh, isn't Kim Jong-il a dick? That's right. It. That's the whole point. It's like there's no
one joke premise.
One joke. It's like, he's a dick.
Franco's performance is elevated though by Randall Parks though. When they have their sort of romance in the movie,
That guy kind of settles down,
and does really well. I think the frustrating part for me is you said you were not dealing with somebody like intelligent or delicate enough to handle this material. And even though like, I think they haven't done it before, but I think they are, and I think that's what makes it disappointing is that they didn't capitalize on what they.
I think they're intelligent and like sophisticated enough to write like really clever jokes, but not entirely political, satirical,
geopolitical jokes.
Like the kind of brevity that takes to write something like that. And the pretty much the only good thing that came out of all this debacle is that on social media and word of mouth, people started talking about The Great Dictator more, which is a great film, which is a film where Charlie Chaplin had some brass balls to make fun of Hitler before Pearl Harbor, before, you know, America really got into the war, before people had really made up their minds, like, Hitler is the bad guy, and he really went after him, and he lampooned him mercilessly. And this is kind of missing that, is that, you know, of course, you're not going to find some, like, sophistication of Chaplin quality in Seth Rogen. But at least if you're going to pick a real country and you're going to go after a real leader, you know, have a little bit more bite to your... Have a little bit more, like, you know...
A little more punch to it. I'll give you that. They are intelligent, but maybe not in their geopolitical sense. I mean,
maybe they need to stick to the sort of insular world that they know.
Yeah, exactly.
This is probably why This Is the End worked so well. It was like feeling like you got some weird skewed glimpse of their actual world filtered through this bizarre end of the world comedy conceit.
That worked right what you know. Most of the time just works out.
Well, we applaud the attempt, but
it's mostly the visual style, I think, that really underwhelmed
that's
me.
That's too bad to hear.
Such a strong, assured visual direction in This Is the End.
Right.
This one was like choppy and kind of all over the place. Bland. And for like a big budget, like action comedy, like trying to bring back that like big action comedy of the yesteryear of like you have films like It's a Mad, Mad World or 1941. Yeah. And in the hands of someone else, this could have been like grand and just like
batshit crazy, but in right. this case, it was just, like, really flat and kind of lifeless,
yep.
the kind of budget that they were given. So it wasn't really a terrible movie, and I don't think you're saying it's
a terrible movie.
It's just
movie.
That it's, especially, you know, after all that, like, attention that it got.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it didn't get that, I would be like, ah, you know, big old whatever.
I'd still be disappointed and overwhelmed by it, I think, even without it.
Interesting.
Exactly. Right. So, my number five is, the one of the main reasons why we have the overrated kind of thing is the Babadook. Because the thing is, Babadook is actually a very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't like really contest that. I don't think it's a bad movie at all. It's very good. It handles the themes that it brings up about loss and the hardships of building, you know, maintaining a family, especially being a single parent and all that stuff, like really, really well. But I just think, like, every year there's, like, this one horror movie, because the genre is so dry
mm-hmm.
the last decade or so, that someone finds a decent, well-made horror movie and clings onto it as if it's, like, the second coming of the genre. And there's one of these movies every year. Every year it gets hyped up to, you know, it's like some classic horror movie director. This year it was William Friedkin, says, like, you know, I shat my pants, I was so scared. It's the greatest horror movie ever made, and this is amazing, and blah, blah. And then it gets hyped up, and then you see it, and it's always kind of like, as a hardcore horror fan, like, it's always kind of leaves me, I don't want to say disappointed, but, like, the hype never really pays off.
Right.
And the case of the Babadook, this was a much better kind of psychological thriller, the way that it deals with its themes, than it was a horror movie. There was no point in there where, you know, usually after you watch a horror movie, no matter how old you get, if you watch a really, really well-made and really effective horror film, there's going to be some times when you're just going to be like, when you're alone in the dark or something.
Exactly, yeah.
The images from it are just going to, like, pop into your head, and, like, nothing like that happened to me with the Babadook. And the thing is, like, it's almost, like, the marketing of this film is, like, selling the Babadook as, like, the, you know, the new monster, as if it's like the new Freddy or something.
Right,
I feel like some of the weaker parts of the film involved this creature. That the acting of the woman and the struggles that he had.
Essie Davis,
she was amazing.
She's phenomenal in this movie.
And the kid was great.
Yep.
And the acting and the dynamic and the struggles and the frustrations that she dealt with, and the kind of lessons that it, you know, gives you about how to deal with depression,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of ending was just like really, the ending of like how she deals with it at the very end was really touching, really well done, but I just don't think it really worked nearly as well as other people say as a horror movie.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair argument, because I found it very well done as a horror movie, but why I think it's actually a great movie, it didn't make my top 10 this year, but it's in the sort of top 20 area somewhere it landed on there, is because I thought the drama was so effective, the character mm-hmm. details, the way the movie deals with unchecked grief and how it can sort of metastasize into a really ugly thing, mm-hmm. quite literally,
mm-hmm.
And the way that it all thematically tied in by the end, and that the ending is what I was most impressed with, because I feel like horror movies, you can tell when, and this happens with most horror movies or mainstream American horror movies, is you can tell they have nowhere to end the movie, so they'll mm-hmm. give you a sort of a last boo jump scare at the end. Mm-hmm. The Babadook never did that, and I was really appreciative that it actually never let the characters off the hook, and the threat of what the Babadook came to, like, what I understood it to be in the movie, it never let it off the hook, and it was just something that actually, in a strange way, I felt very similar to the movie Take Shelter with Michael Shannon, where in the end, depending on how you read it, I found them quite similar in terms of learning to deal with this thing that's never actually going to go away. Mm-hmm. You just need to live with it now. And yeah, I think both movies really effectively pay off on that. And that's why I will defend The Babadook as a great movie, but I totally understand. I think you've laid out.
But as a horror movie, the way that it's been hyped up as, like, you know,
William Friedkin calling it the best horror movie he's seen in years is actually doing no favors to the movie. It's doing favors in that it's going to get eyeballs on the screen, and that's great, because that movie deserves people, an audience. But in terms of really unfair expectations, when the guy that made The Exorcist says, this is the, you know, scariest damn thing I've seen.
Exactly.
It's it can be unrealistic expectations.
Yeah, so I would say, like, you know, it's a very good movie, and the themes, how strong it deals with those themes and how honestly it deals with them,
right,
really creeps up on you because you don't expect it. You just expect, like, some kind of The Ring style, maybe,
exactly,
horror movie with, like, a little kid who's, like, possessed or something like that.
Right.
And I really like that aspect about it, but it's not, I don't find it to be, like, the, you know, every year I keep seeking for that, you know, like, the good horror movie, a great horror movie is going to come along that's going to be, like, amazing. And as far as the genre is concerned, I think this was, in that sense, it was a letdown, but as an overall film that deals with these issues, I thought it was really good. But, you know, the whole point of the overrated is that we pick films that have been just, like, heightened to these status as a genre, and, you know, that doesn't really work that way for me. So what's your four?
Right on. And Ryan, you did not see the
Bob
Dick yet?
The Bob
Okay.
Dick,
well, so I'll be curious to know what you think when you do. So yeah, I'll go with my number four, is Wild. This latest movie from Jean-Marc Vallée. He made Dallas Buyers Club last year, or 2013, had great success with that movie. Awards-wise, the film found an audience. Obviously, Matthew McConaughey won the Oscar, so did Jared Leto. He's been down this road before, this director, and I think it looks like everything in Wild has been sort of pre-packaged to be one of these movies that I just was talking about with The Imitation Game. It's like, on paper, it's a no-brainer. This is going to be up for awards. People love it because it's more of like, one for me, I feel like the movie's finding support because I think women that go to movies, but also just people, are desperate for actually more complex female characters to lead movies. So I love what Wild represents, because at the fore of this movie is a complex female character. I just wish that they got a better actress to portray this character, because I think Reese Witherspoon is really miscast in this movie. I think the movie is unfocused and almost borderline a mess to a degree where I wonder what the movie's actually about. And Ryan, I want to get your thoughts on this, because I'm struggling still, having, now it's been almost a month since I've seen Wild. I actually am not quite sure what the movie is about. Like,
It's just like, does it want to focus on her drug addiction? Does it want to focus on her journey or her relationship with her mother?
Yeah.
I can't disagree with that, only because, like, your statement, because we talked about that with The Imitation Game, which being the spanning story, and so is this one.
Right.
But I think maybe I find myself latching to it because it has a complex female character, because, like, visually it's very good.
See, I would argue. I think it's kind of surprisingly flat visually. Here's the thing, the technical achievement I will applaud the movie is the editing and the sound effects.
And that's what I love.
The sort of sensualist vibe that Jean-Marc Vallée achieved with his editors is, there's a sort of, the way flashbacks, even though I hated the way flashbacks were employed in the movie, I love the way a memory could be triggered from a song, or opening the shower curtain will suddenly match with a flash cut from the past. I love that stuff.
I also like the kind of cross cutting between, like, when she's having a struggle on the trail, and then she's with Gabby Hoffman, is, like, shoveling snow out of her car, and, like, the music's kind of, like, pumping.
Building.
Yep. Things like that. So I don't know. I think there are good things in it.
Exactly.
The more we talk about it, as I know I'm the minority in this group, because I actually enjoyed the movie, but I know that it's got flaws, and I know, like, the more we talk about it, the more I kind of find myself agreeing with you,
I should mention that Wild is my number four too.
Okay, good. Yeah.
So we're moving along.
Yes.
Why would be, you know, most of the stuff that you mentioned, and also kind of what you said about the film kind of being a mess, and coming from a screenwriting standpoint, I feel like this was a film that had four first acts instead of a three act structure. Like, coming down, it's like, and I don't even know if I would agree that she's, like, such a sophisticated female character. I mean, her backstory basically, like, her entire story pretty much belongs in, like, a 20-minute short. What we were talking about earlier, just, like, you know, how you take, like, a short story about, like, oh, you know, she was a drug addict, her mother died, and, you know, she wants to this Pacific Trail hike to find herself. which is fine. I mean, it's like, it has a little bit of that, like, you know, famous saying, it's like the minutiae of your life is not always great drama. And I find a little bit of that here, where I was just like, I had trouble really figuring out, like, why is this person's story that important?
Yeah, you know what the counter-argument to what you just said is yeah. Boyhood. Boyhood is all about the minutiae and how that can be so compelling.
That can, you can make a great movie with that, and that's proof right there.
Right.
And, yeah, it was just, like, basically... an hour and 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I had a screener of this film that was sent to me, and I kept looking at the counter, and it's like an hour and 10 minutes, an hour and 20 minutes. You're still learning stuff about this character that should have been taken care of in the first act.
Yeah.
So it's like, because you're just like, it just takes its time, really. And while giving you this kind of like empty, manic editing style, where it's like, it's almost like. The editing style, it reminded me of the editing from Slaughterhouse 5, which in that, it makes sense, because you're talking about a character who's unstuck in time.
Right.
Who jumps back and forth between time periods. And in this case, it was just like, you know, it felt like the flashy effects of it, which were really effective, but it felt like they were covering up for the fact that they didn't really have a compelling enough story to fill a two-hour movie.
I agree, yeah.
And there was a lot of... And yeah, it's like, that's the thing that bugged me about it. By the time you get to the end, you're just like, all right, we're done with the first act. Let's get the story started, and then it ends.
There's like this tacked-on redemptive like voiceover that kind of comes out of nowhere for me.
It does, because
the
they were seeking an ending. And they had to have like some kind of an ending.
Yeah, and I thought about it like, man... They hired Nick Hornby, a really accomplished novelist and good screenwriter. Like, he's not anywhere to be found in this movie. Exactly. It's very strange, and it feels like a very Hollywoodized, machine-fed sort of quasi-indie that I'm not begrudging anybody that's liked it. I've seen lots of people stay after at the movie theater I work at talking about this movie. Mm-hmm. I think that's great. I love what it represents. I can't like the movie just because I agree, you know, politically with it, or with the fact that we need more characters to at least challenge the idea of, you know, what a female character can be on screen. Like, there needs to be a good movie behind that as well. Mm-hmm. If Wild leads to more movies like that getting made on a more consistent basis, that's great. That's great. But
maybe the true story of a woman who is basically... You know, truthfully, a lot more interesting and...
Would be great. And I'll tell you what, there was a movie called Tracks that came out earlier this year with Mia Wasikowska.
And Adam Driver.
That is the much more interesting, very similar kind of movie, and it got no attention. Now, it's not one of my overrated or underrated picks, but it belongs to be brought up in accordance with Wild, because that movie had the balls to... It stuck with it. It found its tone, the kind of story it was going to tell, and stuck with it. And you're on the trail with her the whole time, as opposed to this... sort of relief that Wild wants to give you by flashing away from the actual, you know, the nitty gritty is like walking. It's doing the journey. And
or
it's...
even the drug use is very like, not even... That's one thing I can say too, like you're talking about this Oscar going crowd, is I've noticed this even working at a theater, and I'm sure you have too.
Absolutely.
People saying how edgy this movie is, but it's like, but we've all seen Requiem for a Dream.
Thank
we've
you,
all
yeah.
seen movies that like deal with that stuff in a very like harsh, gritty way.
Unflinching
and
way.
Exactly. And so like for this audience, who is like the Imitation Game sort of audience, as you, I think we talked off mic, you said this is an edgy movie to them.
Exactly.
Not necessarily to us.
And are they wrong? Absolutely
I
not.
I don't think they're wrong.
It's
just what they're experiencing.
Exactly. So, it's the seeds of the sort of like where I'm just like, why is this the movie that blows people away seemingly? But in the truth, most of the people that are loving Wild go to maybe 3 movies a year. And Wild, it would be... If I saw 3 movies a year, I bet I'd love Wild. And again, that's not a knock, even though it probably sounds that way.
And I think
it's
sorry.
No,
go ahead. I think we also get a little bit more of the overratedness of it because we live here in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
It's a huge deal here in this area because Cheryl Strayed, the author,
the premiere was here.
Yeah. The Pacific Crest Trail goes through here. Yeah. Like, it's a very big deal right now in Portland, Oregon. So... on top of the movie not working necessarily, maybe more so for me than you guys, we're also hearing people like going crazy over it because our area is represented in film, which is not very often.
Exactly. So we're living in that bubble, the hype. So that's there you go. That's why, you know, Wild, I gotta say, it's overrated.
My number 4 was Imitation Game.
All right, my number 4 is Wild, and we get back to...
I put that one right. It's all me, baby.
Man, all
right. All
you spin the showdown wheel. immediately got back to me.
Eric McClanahan, come on down.
Here I go. So I'm really curious what you guys are going to say about this, but my next selection is Big Bad Wolves, which is an Israeli
revenge movie. It's kind of like the opposite coin to something like Prisoners, I would say.
Yeah.
Even a good comparison.
I never thought of that, but very good comparison. I agree. It's a very good comparison. Big Bad Wolves for me is... It starts with a very similar complaint that Octa had regarding The Babadook is we all heard about this movie from one guy. His name is Quentin Tarantino, and he called it, I think, the best film he had seen in 2013 when he saw it at a festival. Mm. Okay, we being the nerds that we are, I tend to take Quentin Tarantino's word as like, I need to see that movie. So that's the reason I wanted to see it. And I kind of, I was warned to lower those expectations from my co-host on Adjust Your Tracking because he saw it before me. But even with that, I still was kind of left wondering, like, why is this the film that got Quentin Tarantino to, like, his panties? Like, why is he all excited about this movie? Like, what's the deal? And ultimately, I think it's a movie that is trying to be funny first, and it's very clear about its tone, which I appreciated. I've seen it twice, and I came around a little bit more in favor of it the second viewing. I still just think, like... It doesn't feel like a full movie. There isn't enough there to hang onto a whole movie. And ultimately, this movie had a really frustrating... I didn't really like the ending of the movie.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the ending. I can give you
that. The ending's mean-spirited in a way that the movie, I felt like, needed to go the other way.
The movie was too playful ahead of that time to where I was just like, it was jarring to no benefit. And that's probably the one knock I can say on the movie.
Yeah.
I liked that the movie was like playful and funny because... As I say with something like Prisoners, I actually thought about picking these two as an over-under in a future episode someday.
Nice.
Because Prisoners has this, like, really somber burden to it that it doesn't ultimately earn by the end of it. And, like, granted, I don't think this movie earns its ending necessarily, but, like, I liked the more playful tone of its, like, I thought it was a... Well, first of all, I guess I didn't have the thing with you about Quentin Tarantino because I don't listen to the guy as much anymore.
You're smarter than me.
Because the same year that he said it was the best movie, he also listed Kick-Ass 2 and The Lone Ranger as well. So to necessarily...
I forgot about Kick-Ass 2.
He liked both of those movies.
I would love to forget about Kick-Ass 2.
I would love to forget about that. But unfortunately, I have not. So I didn't have that burden of expectations. And unfortunately, as much as I'd like to, I don't watch as many foreign films as I'd like to. And most of the ones I watch are genre-oriented.
Right, right.
So to see this movie done better than one I had just seen more recently.
Right.
And the way it kind of, like, it's almost like a grim fairy tale, too, in the way that it's told.
Right, right.
About, like, integrating the story of the Big Bad Wolf with these three, you know, people who are accused of a murder trying to figure out who it is. I was drawn to it. It was also January, so there wasn't a lot of good movies out at that
point. The doldrums, right.
Yeah.
It's all true.
I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying. I was...
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, maybe I'll be soft. Maybe I'll come around more to it. Like I said, when I saw it a second time, I was much more... Forgiving is not the right word. I kind of came around more to appreciating the movie. I had the burden of the ridiculous expectations set by Quentin Tarantino, who is a person that knows movies, but, you know, his taste is different than mine. That's fine. But, I've seen a lot of... There's been a lot of revenge movies that have come out. And I just feel like when you've got stuff as good as... Like, any revenge movie from South Korea is just leaps and bounds more interesting than something like Big Bad Wolves.
True.
I would have loved to see a South Korean take on the same material, but then again, then it would be a Korean movie and not
a very specific Israeli movie.
A
very different culture.
Right.
I guess,
we showed this movie at the other theater I work at, and it was during a Jewish film festival. So that's kind of amazing because that audience is very old. Like, it is an older audience, and they came and saw that movie, like, in droves.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that something like Big Bad Wolves could find its way into a skewing older audience Jewish film festival. That's kind of great. It's very much of its culture and the humor that it takes, the way it deals with mommy daddy issues with its antagonist character. It's funny. I appreciate it, but the ending still just sticks in my craw.
I'll give you the ending. I will 100% stand by you on that.
Yep.
I've had the screener for this film for a while now, and I remember, like, us talking about it a couple times, and you were saying, like, it was, like, disappointing, so I just didn't bother to check it out. Yeah. So we'll see. Yeah. So what's your number three, Ryan?
My number three is Unbroken.
Motherfucking biopic.
I'm calling out another biopic. I am calling out another awards bait movie. If this movie is nominated for any like above the line awards, be it picture or director for Jolie,
I'm gonna be pissed.
I'm gonna be pissed. But it's vindicated of a system that's already so locked into place that it can't be Unbroken.
Well played.
Because this movie was already destined to get that sort of attention.
Right.
Yeah.
Prior to it, it was like, oh, you know, Angelina Jolie's doing it. It's based on this guy's amazing life, Louis Zamperini.
Right.
And it's like, oh, it's going to get all this awards attention. The movie comes out, it's not very good. That's the biggest problem. Like, the only reason...
It's like
the
Imitation doesn't matter, though.
Yeah, The Imitation gets, like, a little bit more credit because it's at least an entertaining movie,
right,
albeit a flawed one.
Right.
Unbroken is not... Just also a very unfocused movie like The Imitation Game. It spans this guy's life from a kid to an Olympic athlete to World War II hero to being in a Japanese prison camp. And the movie is just very sluggishly paced. It doesn't know where to put the emphasis. And there's something that just feels very empty about it. For a guy that lived such an extraordinary life, I bet the book is great. I bet his life. But the problem is these movies have such a similar template that it cheapens what he went through. And so when you get to this prison camp, the last hour is like Passion of the Christ. I assume you have not seen this movie.
I have not seen Unbroken.
Pretty much.
And you've seen it, yes. It's, I mean, albeit not as bloody, sure. But like he just gets beaten and tortured for an hour. And it's like you didn't get to really know him enough as a person or his struggle. But yeah, people are flocking to see this movie. It's almost made $100 million in the box office. People are going to support it. And I just, you know, I think this was a too big a project for Angelina Jolie to take on as a second film. I mean, her first film in The Land of Blood and Honey probably showed, or not probably, if saw it, showed some promise, but I think there needed to be another, like, stepping stone film before taking on this big, broad movie.
And interesting.
She kind of surrounded herself with, like, big-name talent. The Coen brothers were coming
on
the script, who are not even, like, evident in this movie.
Roger
Deakins shot it. One of his more flat movies, I would say.
I'm ready here, man. Yeah. You just always expect to get some... I mean, you brought up Prisoners. That movie looked amazing.
Yeah, the cinematography is the best thing about that movie, and Jake Gyllenhaal. And this movie, it looks flat. A lot of digital recreation that just doesn't look good. Like even
CGI sharks?
Yeah, CGI sharks. Really? From the very beginning on the plane, you can tell they're on a CGI plane. Or they're on like a hollowed part of a plane that they stuck the camera in and did the CGI. And Jai Courtney's in it, so that's automatically just standing for me. But overall, it's just like this actor, Jack O'Connell, like, I think he's fine in it. And I think Domhnall Gleeson, like, there's good performances with the material that they were given. I just think that, like, you know, this movie was already destined for awards consideration and nothing else. And it didn't even live up to the basic of a biopic. So
This will be brief. Yeah. Brett, because I haven't seen the film. But if anybody listens to the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, one of the things I find very interesting that he highlights is that... people seem to be really into the victim narrative right now in these big awards movies. And if you look at the nominees from last year and what will most likely make up a lot of the nominees this year, there's like this like overwhelming sense of like the victim narrative characters. Like we watch characters suffer. Therefore it's like, it makes it elevated and important or something. And it's getting ridiculous. And I've heard Unbroken has these scenes of torture that are like almost comical in how far they go.
Yeah, they are. But whereas something like, you know, again, Selma, very visceral and very like powerful in the movie.
Because there's a point to them.
Exactly. There's a point to them.
There's a point that you're watching that.
And it's like, you know, the intentions are good with this movie. It just doesn't, you know, it's just a very slog of a movie to sit through.
So, first of all, you know, I was like really proud of myself when I, after I watched this movie, I came up with the line, this is the World War II prison camp version of Passion of the Christ.
And, you feel vindicated.
And Ryan beat me to the punch. I thought everybody was going to be like, ah, that's so smart that you came up with that.
Boy, were you wrong.
But anyway, yeah, it's not like, the problem isn't that, first of all, I should mention that this is also my number two pick.
There you go.
My number two pick is, Unbroken, and it's not that this is necessarily a bad movie, but it's incredibly bland.
Yes.
Like it is, it is like the Transformers like the Transformers of like the Oscar bait biopic.
Oh, okay.
Every single beat is predictable. You know exactly where it's going from the first frame on. That you're gonna have like, oh, he's gonna get captured and then he's going to get tortured, but he's going to refuse to lie down. There's the music's going to swell up, and you're going to have this like gorgeous Deacon cinematography. I mean, they threw a shitload of money on these people on this film, and kind of like willy-nilly without any kind of planning, it seems like, too. Why would you give the screenplay for this to the Coen brothers if they're not going to have any, like, identity? There's no Coen brothers in this film at all. It looks like the kind of film that they would kind of lampoon in a film like Big Lebowski.
You would think,
like,
they would, yeah.
Like they would subvert the genre in some way. And there isn't, like, even the tiniest bit of subversion here. Like, every single bit is like, look at how much this guy suffered. But the point is that, exactly like Passion of the Christ, it's pointless torture. Yeah. You just watch, like, you know, and, you know, the first half is just, like, they're stranded on the boat, and that's, like, just terrible, and it has those predictable flashbacks to his youth, where just, like, people were like, you know, and it starts off with, of course, like, you're no good, you're a thief, and you should find something to do with your life. And then it's just like, and his brother is just like, you know, why don't you try running? And then it's like the Olympic and everything.
There's ready-made movie quotes, like, if you could dream it, you could make it, or something like that. Like the worst.
So it's like, the whole thing plays off in a way like a Key and Peele sketch about, like, like these movies, and it would be, like, spot on.
You wouldn't have to change anything. And
then, exactly, you have the performances are... Jack O'Connell, like, dude is fine, I guess. Like, the Japanese guy who tortures him is,
I will,
like...
say this about Jack O'Connell. He's coming up in the other section of this show.
And okay, cool.
It's too bad that I've heard he's just kind of okay in this movie. Just basically...
yeah. He's serviceable. He's right. Exactly what the movie needs.
Because in the movie I'm going to bring up as an underrated pick, he is not serviceable. Okay. He is... You can't take your fucking eyes off guy. When I saw... I'm glad. We'll just leave it at that.
But
it's
anyway,
a shame to hear that with a movie that's getting much more attention.
Much more attention, exactly.
He's sort of serviceable.
And then basically, like, I have... you know, I have an Apple TV, and if you leave it on for too long, it brings up, like, all these... family pictures, like Ken Burns style montage. And I feel like if I watched that for 2.5 hours, I would probably have the same experience as watching Unbroken. And another thing that really pissed me off about this movie is that it ends and he basically, you know, we all know the story. Fucking, you know, World War II ended and, of course, he gets rescued. And
what?
So that's not much of a spoiler. But yeah, of course, you know, you watch him getting the shit kicked out of him for an hour and a half, and then the allies come, and then he gets rescued, the end.
Ugh.
And then, but then there's this, like, post...
The lazy, like, buttonings.
Always. The buttons. Always. But there's this text about, like, here's what happened to him after that. And it tells a story that's 10 times more fascinating and interesting than the one that you just watched.
Yeah.
Because it basically talks about, like, how he found God, he went back to Japan to face his aggressors.
Oh, wow.
And how he, like, you know...
He rejoined the Olympics at age 80, and there was archive footage of him running. And
all this stuff that's, like, actually interesting. And I'm just, like, watching that, and the post, like, the text exposition goes on for, like, 2-3 minutes.
Oh,
like,
Christ.
It goes on forever. And it tells a story... that's 10 times more fascinating than the one that you just watched. And I was just like, why didn't you make a movie out of that?
There was also a very sequel. That was, like, really bad, but I was even talking before that, after they get rescued. Spoiler alert, I'm sure you don't
care. It's okay.
And our audience, if you've seen it already, if you want to see it. They have a moment where he goes into the room of the head guard who has been beaten him mercilessly this whole time, and you see a picture of, like, his dad as, like, a 5-star general in Japan, and you see that, like, he has this, like, almost little man complex that he has to live in his father's shadow, and it's like, that was such a lazy, like, because there's no, like,
so you have to explain
that.
Why he did that.
Yeah, they're like, he did that because, you know, Louis accomplished so much that he's like, I have to feel bigger and beat the shit out of him.
It's like, childlike psychology approaching, you know, like, really, that's supposed to get, I mean, Imitation Game is guilty of a very similar thing, where it's like trying to sum up a person's life and decisions they made based off of, like,
I mean, I guess, you know, there's some stuff that Angelina Jolie shows promise for, but I didn't feel any kind of identity here, like a specific identity for a director. I felt like any kind of director for hire could have pulled this movie off the way that it came off, you know. So it really was like, you know, I mean, there's nothing worse than saying I could have just been watching an empty screen, and it would have been have the same effect.
I'm going to borrow a quote from one of my writers who got to movies, Jonathan Romo. He wrote the review for the site and said, you know, because it was a passion project for Angelina Jolie. He's mm-hmm. like, you know, for a passion project, there doesn't seem to be a lot of passion behind
yeah.
it.
Interesting. Exactly.
Yeah.
Bummer. Exactly. That was your two, so...
That was my number two. My number three is The Theory of Everything.
We're just checking the fucking biopics.
We're going with the biopics this time. I have a biopic in The Underrated, too, so it's like... It's going to be a little bit... It's going to be a little bit balanced, at least. So The Theory of Everything, it's like, you know, I don't hate the fact that, okay, they took the A Beautiful Mind approach and took someone who's like... Who basically changed the world of physics, who was intensely intelligent, and instead of focusing on... his achievements, okay, let's focus on this one chick that he married and then divorced. And then, like, turned that into a love story, and it has all, like, the hokey elements of, like, you know, let's visualize all these moments of inspiration that he had for all his, like,
beautiful
amazing
mind style.
Ideas. So there's all this, like, he looks at, like, a flame, and then, and then like, the flame turns into, like, an animation thing, and he's like, oh, I came up with an idea, Eureka! And so it's incredibly, by the numbers, simplistic, and focuses way too much on the love story. Mm-hmm. And, but the... apart from all of that, the main thing that really bugged me about it is that when I saw the trailers and when I knew a little bit about this movie, I thought it mostly focused on Stephen Hawking and his wife's youth, like when they were in college together and stuff like that. So the casting made a bit more sense. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, you know, they cast some young-looking people to play those parts. And then when my wife and I, Gabby and I, were watching the movie, and after 20 minutes, it, like, starts jumping ahead in time. Right, and they start becoming, like, 30 years old, 40 years old, 50 years old.
You know what that means?
Were just, like...
old age makeup?
Yeah, but it's, like... But we're looking at each other... But we're looking at each other, and we're just, like, they look like they're 12.
Yeah.
Like, it's after a while, it just turns into, you know, the way that these films are usually made, if you're going to span so much time, maybe cast someone who's, like, in the middle range.
Mm.
And with those kinds of decisions, usually what happens is that when they show them when they're young or when they're high school students, that's when it looks ridiculous. But it's only, like, a 5-minute or a 10-minute sequence. Like, think about, like, Forrest Gump when they show him, like, he's supposed to be in high school and it's, like, 45-year-old.
Or Reese Witherspoon in Wild.
Yeah, exactly.
That too.
So that looks ridiculous, but okay, you can deal with that. But when you have a film where the casting makes sense for the first 20 minutes and it just looks ridiculous for the last, like, 100... it's ridiculous. I mean, it looks like, to me, it looked like a bad, like, high school drama production with, like, a bunch of high school students playing, like, 40, 50-year-olds. And it becomes even more ridiculous down the line when, you know, there's a kind of an affair that happens with a church choir, like, keyboardist and Stephen Hawking's wife. And that guy is played by... someone who's in his mid-30s and the... what, I forgot her name, but...
Felicity Jones.
Felicity Jones. Mm. I mean, she's not really that young. She's in her, like, mid to late 20s.
She looks really young.
She looks really young.
Yeah, absolutely.
And with that kind of, like, bad old-age makeup where it looked like they just sprayed, like, the white hair on her head, you know? And it's just, like... And then later on down the line, which this is also based on a true thing, is that Stephen Hawking started a relationship with his nurse. But Stephen Hawking is supposed to be, like... in his 40s, and Eddie Redmayne, like, still, he's a really young-looking dude.
He's extremely
young. And they cast someone who's, like, legitimately in her 40s, and, you know, you're supposed to be worried about, like, oh, is he going to have an affair? What's going to happen? And the whole time, the only thought that was going through my head was just, like, statutory rape.
This is just
like,
wrong.
I'm like, this looks wrong. She's, like, she's actually 40. I know he's playing a 40-something-year-old, but...
Huh.
So that really bugged me, and the fact that it was just, like, so lazy with that A Beautiful Mind approach, that really bugged me. But I guess you saw it, and you liked that movie, so...
I liked it, and mainly, I was surprised by it. Number one, I thought they were going to focus on the love story in their youth as well. And as weird as this is to say, because we're shitting on, like, the decade spanning, I was actually okay with that in this movie. And the reason I was... is because I know that their relationship ended in a divorce. So I'm like, I don't want to focus on this love story that, like, that is going to end up bad in the end.
Mm-hmm,
or that, like, I've seen other types of movies where something will happen to a character. Or, like Curious Case of Benjamin Button. This is the one that pops in my head. Where at the end of that movie, he gets dementia and everything gradually, like, rapidly happens bad. Like, really, really quick in the third act.
Right.
The performance that Redmayne gives, because in the first 20 minutes, he shows signs of getting ALS.
Mm-hmm.
So I give you the old age makeup, is not good in this movie. It's not very convincing. But the physicality that Eddie Redmayne gives in this
performance... he gives it his all.
He deserves the accolades that he's getting for this performance. And I think Felicity Jones is very good, too, because...
She's a great actress, yeah.
Because his ALS and the complications with that put such a strain on their relationship that you see the struggles through that. Even though the makeup isn't, you know, maybe that convincing, and maybe it does have those familiar story elements... I was impressed with those two actors enough. And I thought it was visually well shot. The director, James Marsh, who did Man on Wire.
He's an Oscar winner for that film.
Yeah, exactly.
An amazing documentary.
There's some gorgeous-looking scenes in this movie. Mm-hmm. I expected this, out of like all these biopics that we've been talking about, to be like the, fuck that. That looks terrible. And other than one that's going to pop in the underrated, and Selma, this is one of the better ones for me.
Interesting. So, right. I mean, when there's so many to choose from, I mean, you know, we're going to have differences.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's, to me, the problems start with the casting alone. From that point on, I mean, they give their all, they give good performances, but, you know, they could have all, you can find, like, an amazingly talented 12-year-old girl and a boy to play that part. It's still going to look ridiculous.
True. I can't deny that.
And, yeah, it does have some really gorgeous scenes. I'm a little bit pissed, maybe, that it focuses on the love story as opposed to... There's a great movie to be made about Stephen Hawking's like scientific achievements and stuff like that.
Well, this was based on her book.
Her book,
So I felt where I didn't feel any passion in Unbroken, I felt more passion behind this movie, despite some of its more.
Well, that's why Unbroken is number two to my
And that's why Imitation and Unbroken were on mine, and this one wasn't. Like, I can see where it is overrated, though. I can't. Yeah. I can't fault you for that.
So, Eric, what's your number two?
So, my number two is, I guess, fittingly enough, a two-part movie, and it's Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac. And I am talking about the U.S. theatrical release, so it's the two movies, the two parts combined, made about... It's over 4 hours.
A little over four.
Yeah. This is one of my least pleasant movie experiences of the year, for sure. And the thing I don't get is well, I mean, I guess I just don't get all the love for this movie. It's on a lot of top 10 lists. The site I write for, The Playlist, it ended up on our staff poll number 14, best film of the year. I was the only person really arguing against it. And I think it's probably the worst Lars von Trier film that I've seen. I've seen, I feel like, the majority of his work, not all of it. And I tend to like most of the stuff of his I've seen. And in fact, he's coming off of, in my mind, when I'm watching the first Nymphomaniac, I'm like, he's just coming off of one of his best films, Melancholia, in my mind. I thought a fantastic piece of work. And the thing that really bothers me the most about Nymphomaniac is it has, for one, the worst ending of any movie this year. The, yes, the Volume 2 has the worst ending of any movie. Undoes everything that you, if you cared about anything that was going on in the movie, it is like the most childish fuck you to the audience. But even more so than that is, I think von Trier's biggest error is that it's boring. It's dull. It's didactic. It's a mouthpiece for him to just basically spew a bunch of like defenses for his sort of public persona, his the things he tends to say that gets him in trouble, and it's not really what I thought could have made it interesting is this like epic exploration, a detailed epic exploration of a woman's sexuality, you know? That's not really what this movie is, and instead it's ultimately just Lars von Trier like riffing on the fucking Fibonacci sequence and a bunch of like masturbatory stuff, you know, no pun intended. And I thought, okay, part one leaves it so much of a cliffhanger that I'm like, maybe he's going to write this ship because I wasn't really into the first one. But volume two just goes completely off the rails, not just with the final scene, but
from the get-go,
it just
really
gets progressively like more inane and just stupid, where
silly
the situations that she gets in. I mean, there's a part where Charlotte Gainsbourg becomes like a sort of a tough guy for like Willem Dafoe, who's this like mobster, and it's just like the silliest plot line ever. And yeah, for all those reasons, I mean, I think it's not only one of the most overrated movies of the year, I think it's easily one of the worst films I sat through altogether. And for me, a huge step backward for von Trier, because I really liked Antichrist. I thought Melancholia was an even greater addition to a similar idea. And then I feel like just this huge step backward, and now that he's kind of coming out in the press lately, that he is sobering up, and that Nymphomaniac was actually the first film he's made apparently sober. I don't know if you guys have been hearing about him in the press. Man, I don't know how to say this without sounding really, like, I don't know, cold or something, but
maybe he should go back to the booze, because I think it makes him a more interesting filmmaker. Like, this film, when I learned that, I was like, that makes so much sense to me, because the movie feels like he's got nothing left in him.
Coming down.
Yeah, it feels like coming down, and it has a dullness from that, and I just can't forgive the fact that even other movies of his I hate, like Dogville, they're not dull. They're never boring. He never has made a boring movie until he made Nymphomaniac. And I just, you know, for all those reasons, I just detest
the movie. So have you seen this?
I've seen it. And, you know, I'm not as big a fan as Von Trier as you are. Uh-huh. But, like, you know, I take it as I go. Each film I assess as I go. I don't have, like, I don't love them. I don't hate them. But, yeah, this movie is just a waste of time, I feel. My life would have been no different had I just not sat for 4 hours and watched this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right completely about the second movie. Yeah. The first one's, like, got interesting ideas for it. Like, it's got a propulsiveness to it, at least, that
it's
I
got
was,
some
like...
funny moments in it.
Yeah, I was interested, even though I felt like, you know, the direction was very bland and some of the performances were really bland.
Right.
But yeah, that second act, like, everything goes... Even the more scenes that you would think would be more raw, like the Jamie Bell's, like, whipping...
Right.
You just know, thing that, you know, yeah, it's just, you know, it's dull, it's monotonous, and you're just put through... things that you're like, why am I sitting here? Well, I'm not benefiting from this, good or bad. Like, I'm not feeling anything while watching this.
Well, and Von Trier even, like, copies similar ideas he's put on. There's a scene in Nymphomaniac Volume 2 that is almost exactly this opening scene from Antichrist, where he teases that a little baby is going to fall out the window. Same music cue and everything. And I found that, like, borderline insulting. Like, are you that much out of ideas?
Lazy.
Sober? Yeah,
really,
are you that lazy?
Yeah.
That you think I wouldn't, like... And it, not in a playful way that he's riffing off of the same idea. It just felt very, like, I got nothing else on this scene, so let's just film it like I did already with Andy.
Well, I'm not a big Von Trier fan. I've been critical of him on many, many occasions, especially, like, his year 2000 on, like, the millennial
Super crazy Von Trier.
The super crazy, batshit crazy Von Trier. But, yeah, you're right. No matter what he's done, he has never really been boring. And I checked out, like, I started watching... Nymphomaniac, and after about 20-25 minutes in, I was just like, I'm not gonna sit through this. And then you guys described to me in detail what happens at the end.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck yeah.
Seriously. It's like a Simpsons joke, the way it fades
and
to
the
black.
Song, and the song that you say plays at the
god.
End.
Oh, God.
I literally expected it to say executive producer Matt Groening.
Yeah. It was just like a Simpsons gag where it fades to black, you hear the footsteps running off. It's so bizarre.
And the song choices, too, is so painfully
on the
nose.
Born to Be Wild, when the girls are, like, fishing for guys to have
sex
with.
It's like, did Ron Howard make this movie? Like, some of the song choices are
Or Robert Zemeckis.
Robert Zemeckis.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So, yeah, I mean, it's Nymphomaniac's one of those movies where when I see it on a lot of colleagues' best of lists, I just throw up my hands. I'm like, I don't get it. What are you talking about? You know? So, it's not
a
good movie.
Let's get to Ryan's second.
Ryan's number two is also a movie that's on a lot of colleagues' top 10 lists. Mm. Also on the playlist top movie of the year. That I just have to throw up my hands in the air and say, I don't get it. And that's Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive.
Yes.
This movie is like the equivalent of an old man shouting how he doesn't get the way of society for 2 hours. Like, the way current things are. And, like, the idea behind this movie is really interesting, I thought. You have, you know, you have, who's even in this movie?
Tom Hiddleston
and Tilda Swinton.
Right.
Okay, so they're vampires, they've lived forever, they've, you know, experienced all this art and this culture, and, you know, they're just, like, they're bored of it all. Like, Tom Hiddleston's character is suicidal, basically, but he can't die, really, unless he, you know, hits himself with a stake.
He does get a wood, he gets a wood bullet built, and he is contemplating
Anton Yelchin, who's, but this movie just, it's 2 hours long. If this movie was 90 minutes, I might be a little bit more forgiving about it, but it's meandering, and just, like, and pretentious, which is fine. Like, pretentious movies can be fine too.
Oh yeah.
But I just felt, again, I just felt this movie was the equivalent of an old man saying, like, I don't get today's society, I don't get today's music, because, like, they're all, like, you know, we hate to use the word hipster, we don't, but but that's kind of applicable to the characters.
Absolutely.
It's
they're a
like,
charming
yeah,
movie, man. They're
exactly.
all hipsters
He's
in
all
his
cool.
movies. Yeah.
But, like, I love some of his movies. Like, I love Ghost Dog, I love Dead Man, I love Stranger Than Paradise, but this just, everyone was saying this is, like, his return to form. This is his, like, you know, best movie in a long time. And so I was really excited to see it. I didn't feel it. It just felt really, like, dull to me. And even the way it's shot, too. The digital style doesn't really fit him, I don't think, as a filmmaker. I just thought it looked really flat and just meandered for a really long time.
Okay.
I haven't seen this.
You did not get a chance? I've seen it twice, and for me it was a better second viewing.
Interesting.
And that's the only way I've ever liked a Jim Jarmusch movie is when I've had enough, want to watch it again. So, for instance, wasn't crazy about Dead Man the first time I watched it. Wasn't crazy about Ghost Dog. But every time I watch those movies, I like them a lot more every time.
So maybe I should give it a second
time. Only Lovers, I'm not going to argue it as even one of the 30 best movies of 2014. It's not. It's something I enjoyed. And, you know, the only visual panache the movie has is that opening credits where the camera's spinning over the stars.
And the music's just like kind of the
I love the soundtrack of this
the
movie.
The music is really
very
good.
Very drone heavy. Yeah.
The performances are good,
too. They're great. I think Tilda Swinton has had a very good year. Had an extremely good year. And her and Tom Hiddleston are so great as an extremely, sexy, almost very realistic take on what it would be like to be a couple that long.
Yeah.
Really works.
They're also super pale, both of them.
He's very pale, I understand where you're coming from, and yet I kind of like the movie, but not enough to even defend it any more than I just have.
I don't dislike the movie by any stretch of the word. It's just one of those movies where, I don't dislike it the way you dislike Nymphomaniac. Right. It's one of those I see it popping up on a lot of top ten lists. And I'm just like, I didn't feel it.
Yeah. It doesn't feel substantial enough to really be on a top to sound.
Especially in such a great year.
It doesn't feel substantial enough to be the length of the movie is. I know. 80, 90 minutes, something like Stranger Than Paradise for this movie, probably would have loved it. Would have thought it was great. But it just goes on too long. Too many literary references that are unnecessary. there's a scene where Tilda Swinton's got these IDs and one of them's Daisy Buchanan from The Great Gatsby. It's like, what? Why? What is that even necessary?
That's Jarmusch, man.
Yeah. But yeah, it was just kind of a disappointment, but maybe I'll give it a second try sometime down the road. But his movies, if they work for me, they usually work for me on the first view.
Interesting. Okay, yeah.
So, my number two is Unbroken, and that movie does not deserve another any more time. Yeah, so let's move on to drumroll. Number ones.
To the movie
on just... Bottom ones.
For me, it's my most overrated movie. I just don't get it. Goodbye to Language 3.
Yes.
The Jean-Luc Godard, movie. Yeah, and I'll usually defend the Godard that I've seen, and which is 60s era strictly. Yeah. And I like most of what I've seen. I think he's made a few complete, almost masterwork classics. I will vouch for Breathless. I'll vouch for Band of Outsiders. I'll vouch for Contempt. Now, Goodbye to Language 3D. The only way I can describe the experience of watching this movie is like watching a schizophrenic's Vine page just strung together... completely at random, in 3D, and also it's the longest 74 minutes I've ever spent in a movie theater. So I'm all for experimental, it's not fair to call this a documentary because it's not, but just an experimental cinema, I'm all for it. I want to know more about that kind of film. It's definitely more of a blind spot for me. But I've seen some abstract experimental works that were just light years ahead of this. And I just feel like this movie is extremely lazy. It feels very tossed off. Like, fuck it, just put it out there. It's in 3D. There's a few great little nifty camera tricks. But other than that, I detested this movie. It was an unpleasant experience to watch it. And the fact that it's on so many top tens... Because it's not like a lot of people saw this movie. I'm not arguing that it's overrated because a lot of people saw it.
It's in a lot of it was picked as the National Film Critics
Best Film of the Year.
Best Film Award, yeah.
Okay, a bold decision, but what? Did we watch the same movie? And when I looked at reviews for it, I just remember feeling very perplexed. Like someone on the critic for The Dissolve called it fun. I don't get how you'd watch this movie and find it fun. But I don't know. I mean, that's the beauty of everybody's opinion can be that different. But we played this movie for a week at my theater and I almost apologized to everybody that walked out because they were just all what the fuck was that all about? And I was like, I don't know, man. I'm sorry. And I'm glad he tried to do something with 3D. I just think historically renowned filmmakers have done much more interesting things with 3D, like Martin Scorsese, fucking Ang Lee did great things with 3D. Vim Wenders with Pina 3D.
Alfonso Cuarón.
I mean, Werner Herzog with The Cave of Forgotten Dreams. These are all much more interesting directors that are in a similar ballpark with Godard. Yet Godard is just gets this like auteurist glad-handing thing where it's like he got to, this film played in competition in Cannes. If you look at the lineup for the Cannes Film Festival from 2014, it's like, I've seen the majority of them. It just does not belong.
Yeah, but doesn't he, because just doesn't, because of his name, he's going to get an automatic pass?
It's because
pass.
It's Godard. And man, some of the best films I have seen out of Cannes 2014 didn't make competition. They made the sort of second tier, I think it's called the Fortnite thing, that it's a shame. I mean, for me, one of the best films of the year, Force Majeure, wasn't in competition at Cannes because fucking Godard got that slot, you know? And it's just, we need to, like, just because it's Godard doesn't mean he gets to be, like, the you know, part of the, that sort of, to be the king of that hill. It's quite annoying, so. Unpleasant movie. I don't know, man.
Have you seen this?
I've not seen it, no.
I haven't seen it. I wouldn't be caught dead seeing it. You know, my feelings for French New Wave, especially Godard. Not French New Wave. I was just saying Godard.
Yeah.
Because I always say the wrong French New Wave director died.
Truffaut.
We should have had Truffaut. If I had to say, you know, if I had a direct connection to God, I would be like, take this old crusty motherfucker and bring back Truffaut. But you know, you don't always get your way. Of course, John Lennon was the first to die of the Beatles. So
this is true.
Anyway, yeah, it's everything I see from Godard, like 1960 something on, like late 60s on, has just looked like horseshit. And a couple of years ago, he had a film came out, like Film Socialism or something like that. Yep. Everything I saw about that just like pissed me off to no end.
Very similar from what I understand.
The like uber pretentiousness of it, and everything I see about Goodbye Language, I have absolutely no desire to see this in 2D or 3D or whatever. So it sounds very, very appropriate to me, even though I haven't seen it. So
keep it that
what's
way.
Your number one?
My number one is St. Vincent. And it's a movie that I really had no intention of seeing whatsoever. Really close friend of mine from film school. We like to recommend movies to each other and check things out. It's a good way. I love that to keep the conversation going.
Absolutely.
He said he really, really liked this movie. I said, I don't know, man. I don't think I'm going to like it, but I'll go see it because you told me it was good. And I hated it. It's not only is it like overrated movie, I just flat out hate this movie. It's Bill Murray playing an old, drunk, broke curmudgeon who befriends a mother and her kid who move in next door, and you can pretty much fill in the rest. Like, it's really easy to
doesn't
see.
Doesn't sound like
it's
a stretch
for
Murray.
Away.
Yeah.
Not a stretch at all. Like, he's fine in it, but he's predictably fine in it.
Yeah.
And it's just, overall, it's just a complete and utter waste of time. I saw where it was coming from beginning to end. It got, like, decent reviews, but the problem, like, this movie actually made pretty good money. As far as, like, some of these, like, mainstream art house crossover movies, it's not an art house movie by any stretch, but
it's an indie,
it's
quasi,
an indie quasi indie, indie movie, yeah. So it got a lot of attention, a lot of people loved it. Naomi Watts got a SAG nomination for this movie.
I heard she's terrible.
She's awful, and this is the worst performance I've ever seen.
Does she do, like, a
give.
Bad Russian act? Like,
it's
accent?
As bad as John Malkovich's in Rounders. Ooh. Yeah, it's a bad Russian accent. And she's a pregnant hooker who, I like...
Yeah.
She thinks that Bill Murray's the father, and he's the one, like, paying, taking care of it. There's a couple, like, nuanced scenes between Murray and his wife, who has dementia, who's in a care facility.
Mm.
And so he gives a little bit of nuance to that, but other than that, it's very broad. The kid in the movie is, like, the movie's called St. Vincent. The kid is going to a Catholic school, or going to a, they call it, like, a mixed religion school, because they accept everybody.
Right.
And they're doing a presentation on saints. Like, early on in the movie, they foreshadow they're doing it on saints, and you pick your saint, like, you find someone who's a real-life saint. I'm like, well, fuck, I know where this movie's going, so this is just, like, I'm benefiting from nothing from this movie. So it was ultimately just a complete and utter waste of time for something that I knew was going to be a complete and utter waste of time, but for my friend, I watched it.
But is it, or did it get good reviews?
Yeah, I think I checked the Rotten Tomato score. It was like 74%.
Whoa.
So that's
when it premiered
good.
At Toronto, it was one of the big hits of that festival.
Yeah,
it was so, like, much so they thought, like, Imitation Game won the audience award of that festival,
and you
which
can
is
see
a big
why.
Precursor
mm-hmm.
for, like, movies that'll go on to sometimes win Best Picture. Mm-hmm. 12 Years a Slave won it the year before.
Yeah.
So you can see King's Speech won it its year.
Right. And it's the Weinsteins.
It was in
and
that
they
ballpark,
know
yeah.
how to market an Oscar campaign.
They do.
So I knew the second that this movie was getting, like, remotely good reviews and response from audience, they were going to campaign Murray. It's not going to happen, fortunately.
Yeah. It's a competitive year.
Yeah, it's just too competitive. But it's just one of those movies that, again, I'm just ashamed of myself for going. Because I just knew it was going to be a waste of time.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's too bad. That's
yeah,
too bad
from seeing the trailer alone, that just made me feel like, yeah. And then I saw that it got, like, semi-decent reviews and I talk to you about it, and every single thing you describe to me about it just sounds like, you know, the movie's utter horseshit.
Yeah, it's a movie. I
bullet dodge there.
It's a movie like The Judge, a movie that actually like downright. That was my bottom movies of the year.
Yeah.
It's a movie that's not a good movie for us movie lovers because we know and see the beats coming from a mile away. Right. But it's very good at appearing at being a good movie.
Yeah.
And that's almost more annoying than a bad movie.
Which is absolutely
that's
is.
Very annoying.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely. Right. So my number one, you know, we talked about last time when we talked about this episode, we said, like, let's not put in any of our, like, movies that are in our worst list or movies in our best list. And I kind of figured, like, you know, I kind of allowed myself one from each, from one from overrated, one from underrated, like, one from my worst list to go into the overrated, the film that I think is, like, bafflingly got, like, good reviews. And for me, the number one is Lucy. Is that it didn't get horrible reviews, it got some actually pretty good reviews, and I was shocked to find this in some people's like top 10 lists. Some people saying it as like we expected it to be a dumb action movie, but it turned out to be like this really trippy trip down like time and space, and it's just like Luc Besson intercuts all this like nature footage into his movie and stuff like that, and this is a really, really dumb movie.
Yeah.
And it's like it's the quintessential like dumb person smart movie.
Sure.
Like the kind of movie that really stupid people would watch and say like, oh, that was really smart. I mean, it basically takes like a pseudoscience that's been debunked like over and over again and just attaches all this really just like off the wall crazy shit to it that it basically like turns into Matrix, but it's in the real world.
Okay.
So there isn't, you're not even holding on to this, like, you know, in screenwriting it's called the one lie that you can tell in the screenplay that says like, okay, these are the rules of this universe, and then you can just go from there.
Right.
And there's nothing like that. It's just like really chirpy, really incredibly stupid.
Mm.
There are some stuff in there where it's just like, it's like bad good, like where it's like, you know, there's one scene where like Scarlett Johansson is like doing the Vulcan mind meld with a he's like a Korean bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just ridiculous. Oh,
isn't the guy from Oldboy in this?
Yeah, Choi exactly. Min-sik. And it's just, it kind of makes itself up as it goes along. It makes absolutely no sense. It's incredibly dumb. And just, I was just like baffled by the fact that not only could anybody really like give it such favorable reviews, but that it could even enter anybody's like top 10 list.
That's baffling to me.
Yeah.
You've not seen this?
I have not seen it. I still want to though. It sounded like fun, but I was on board
the first two thirds of this movie. It's like utter like crazy stupidity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The third act, what the fuck? It tries to get into some like weird like technological singularity, like some of the stuff that Transcendence tried to get into and miserably failed. But like, this doesn't belong in this movie. That's the biggest problem, I think. It's sort of a, I didn't pick this as an overrated, even though I completely agree with 100% that you're saying. The only reason I didn't is because this movie made a shitload of money too.
We should mention
$400 million. And I think that's kind of why I didn't, only because it's like, you know, like we talked about with Wild, more female centric action movies would be great to have. And even though this movie is pretty dumb, if the success of this movie can spawn other better ones,
right,
then I'm okay with the success of it. And it is Luc Besson's best thing he's done in a while. Like, it's still dumb and, like, nonsensical and disappointing.
Well, that's not much of a compliment.
It isn't, but I don't know. I agree, though. This movie goes completely off the rails. When people were coming out with analytical articles when this movie came out.
Yeah.
I didn't even bother to read them because I'm sitting there like, why?
Why bother?
There's nothing to analyze about this. The first hat,
Emperor's like, got no clothes. Why would you analyze the clothes that don't exist?
The first act is like a cross between
Limitless
and a TED Talk.
Exactly.
Morgan Freeman.
Morgan Freeman
is
straight up
Morgan
gives a
Freeman
TED Talk
thing.
And the opening scene has like the mobsters are closing on Scarlett Johansson, and he intercuts it with like National Geographic footage of animals closing in on predators closing in on a deer. But yeah, there's like animal humping footage too.
Yeah, he's talking about like.
By the way, one third of this movie, I'm not even kidding, is straight up like Planet Earth footage.
Wow, dude. Wow.
Not a bad pick for number one.
Yeah. This was horrible. I can't understand anybody. And especially if you're part of that group who says that Interstellar was like too dumb, yet yet you think Lucy is smart. Like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah, you got issues with those folks.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was my number one, and right. I guess we're done with the
enough negativity.
Yeah, let's get to some positivity. Let's get to some good stuff. And this brings us to the end of the first episode. Check out the next episode where we're going to be talking about our underrated picks. See you soon.